The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. The chemical weapons attack in Salisbury on a Russian double agent and his daughter has provoked a diplomatic backlash in Britain and crisis talks at the UN and NATO.
They have treated the use of a military-grade nerve agent in Europe with sarcasm, contempt and defiance. So, Mr. Speaker, there is no alternative conclusion other than that the Russian state was culpable for the attempted murder of Mr. Skripal and his daughter.
As Russia denies responsibility and threatens retaliation, how should Britain respond to the growing crisis? Meanwhile, Jeremy Corbyn comes under fire for his response.
How has she responded to the Russian government's request for a sample of the agent used in the Salisbury attack to run its own tests?
We'll look at the reaction from Britain's allies and hear from our correspondent in Moscow. Plus, blink and you missed it. Philip Hammond's spring statement may have been a fiscal non-event, but austerity is very much still on the menu. We'll hear from the IFS's Paul Johnson.
Whereas most working age benefits would have risen by 3% in normal times next month, they're not going to rise at all, and so that's quite a big real cut to the incomes of people.
But first, on Monday, the government warned Russia that unless it could explain the attack on a former spy and his daughter in Salisbury, it would take action. So on Wednesday, Theresa May announced the expulsion of 23 diplomats with potentially further sanctions to come. Well, I'm joined on the line now by the Conservative MP Tom Tugendhat, who's chair of the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee. Tom, kicking out embassy staff is a serious move from the government, isn't it? But should it have gone further, perhaps in financial sanctions on Putin's cronies in London?
Well, look, it is a serious move, as you rightly say. And what the Prime Minister did yesterday was she pointed towards sanctions. She wasn't specific as to what sanctions she would use, but she has pointed very strongly that there would be action taken. So, look, I'm going to be watching and waiting and holding her to account, because she's right that it's simply not acceptable for the Kremlin regime to behave in this barbarous fashion in the United Kingdom.
Do you think the government's been too relaxed sometimes about the extent to which we've been happy to allow Russian oligarchs to make their home here, spend their money here, enjoy their lives here?
Yes, I do. And I think work by journalists like Oliver Bulow in your own paper and Heidi Blake in BuzzFeed have demonstrated quite what the effect of this can be, not just on the corrupting effect and the destructive effect on the Russian people, because, of course, much of this is stolen from the Russian people, and most of the people murdered by the Kremlin are, of course, Russians in Russia. But it could also corrupt our own country.
And what have you made so far of the response from Britain's allies?
Well, I have to say I've been extremely pleased by the response by our allies. You know, once the Prime Minister made clear her position on Wednesday, they were very quick to state that they were with us. I spoke to colleagues in opposite numbers in places like France and Germany, and indeed further afield in Europe and around the world. I can tell you very clearly that parliaments around the world are absolutely clear that although this incident happened in the UK, it isn't an attack on the UK so much as an attack on everybody in the West, and they very much feel that.
And you haven't always been entirely complimentary about the Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, have you? How do you think he's handled this so far?
You don't need me to repeat my views on that. But I think actually he's there and he's been making the case. So I'm very pleased that that the government has been doing so. But it's not just up to the Foreign Secretary. You know, that's why I've been spending a lot of time on the phone these last few days to chairs of foreign affairs committees in other countries and to parliamentarians I know, and indeed to members of the Bundeskanzleramt and the Elysee Palace. So, you know, I've been, various of us have been working the phones too, because, of course, this isn't a time when it's simply government-to-government relations. This is people-to-people relations, and we've got to make sure that we work together.
Talking of people-to-people, should we be boycotting the World Cup, as some are suggesting? We're not sending any royals. Should we be sending the team?
Well, look, I'm not a believer in mixing sport and politics. I think it always ends up to be somewhat unfortunate. But I am deeply concerned that we must make sure that we have proper consular protection in place for any fans who decide to travel, because we do know that some Russian politicians have been very active in supporting some of their more violent hooligans. And therefore, this is not in the same way as in the UK, where hooliganism has been stamped on very hard by the authorities. At times in Russia, it's been positively encouraged, and this could leave many of our fans in a somewhat exposed position.
Tom Tugendhat, thank you very much. Well, I'm joined now by my panel, Deputy Political Editor Anne Perkins, our columnist Raphael Baer, and on the line from Moscow, Andrew Roth. So, Andrew, you're in Moscow. How has this been playing out in Russia this week? And will the expulsion of these diplomats have any effect more than the symbolism?
So I think that there's a lot of interest here in Russia in the situation in general. You know, it's constantly on television, talking heads and members of the government are all rushing to journalists to be shown to be kind of really supportive of Russia, patriotic. They really want to show that they're standing up to the British aggression, you know, over this case and how, you know, they're basically being accused without any kind of motive or any kind of proof. At least that's how it's being played out in Russia. As to what's going to happen with the diplomats, it's hard to say. I mean, there's one level of it is that the you know, on the British side, they said that they've kicked out diplomats who are involved in intelligence operations. I mean, that could likely have an effect on Russian intelligence operations in Great Britain. But, you know, obviously we don't know the scope of that straight away. In terms of what the actual effect of the sort of British decision is going to be, of the measures that have been taken, I mean, my sense here in Moscow was that there was somewhat of a bit of a relief, a sense that it wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been, a sort of lackluster response to the Russian action. So my expectation this week is that the Russians will expel a certain number of diplomats, at least 23. They'll look for some sort of parity or reciprocity. I can't see any other big steps that they're going to take at the moment. You know, they might make some symbolic steps to push back against British illegality in Russia. I don't know in what sense. And that's it. I assume that we'll move on.
And are there tougher things that we could have done, do you think? I mean, there is talk of sort of economic measures targeted against particular individuals. We don't know what the details of those are yet. And another thing that's been much talked about here in the newspapers is boycotting the World Cup. That's another thing that's been discussed. What would have hit harder, do you think, than just sending a few diplomats home?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of views here. I mean, one thing that could have hit quite hard probably would be any immediate economic measures. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of promise and sort of aspiration in May's statements about a kind of new Britain that's going to focus much more on where the money from Russia is coming from and have sort of closer financial regulation. But I think that if there had been kind of immediate measures set out there that were more concrete or any kind of, you know, at least like a kind of statement and a kind of action that would show that the British government is really serious about this, then I think that would have had more of an effect in Russia. I think that would have included, you know, specific actions that could have been taken right away rather than a statement that, you know, we're going to develop some sort of legislation, which at which point I think the Russians in general tune out. I mean, there was also discussion about possibly blocking Russia Today's broadcast license. Mm. I think that to a certain degree, you know, the Russians would have taken that very seriously. You know, whether or not that would have a serious effect on Russia's influence in Great Britain, I think is very much up for debate. But I think that certainly could have led to Russia seeking to escalate by possibly expelling the BBC or expelling all British journalists like they said they would. So, I mean, that statement, I don't know what it would do necessarily to influence, you know, to affect Russian influence in Great Britain, but it certainly would have made more of a statement, I think, over here.
And let's talk about the debate in the House of Commons where Theresa May announced these measures and Jeremy Corbyn responded. It was quite a highly charged moment, wasn't it? There's a particular mood, I always think, that comes over MPs when this sort of matters of national security are concerned.
It was just two things, wasn't it? It was the matters of national security when MPs feel a weight of history on their shoulders. But it was also because it was the second go for Jeremy Corbyn, and he was widely felt to have let the side down on Monday by appearing to try to make political points rather than stand shoulder to shoulder with the government at a time of national crisis. And he upset a lot of his backbenchers at that point. And although he appeared to be trying harder and to be more sensitive to the pressure from behind him yesterday, he still managed to upset them a great deal by appearing, as our editorial suggested this morning, to be prepared to make allowances for a country which the Prime Minister had accused of an act of aggression against Britain. And there was clearly a huge amount of rage, probably been brewing since Monday, which erupted into a series of really very charged interventions from Labour backbenchers, which, of course, the Tory backbenchers and indeed the Prime Minister were thrilled about and couldn't wait to welcome and to highlight the distinction between what Mr. Corbyn's backbenchers were saying and what he himself was saying.
But Raf, to some extent, this is just Jeremy being Jeremy, isn't it? He has a long-standing view that you know, you shouldn't jump to conclusions about these kinds of matters, that you have to go through international processes, use the institutions that exist, you know, all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, he does. To be honest, I think that's quite a generous interpretation of the long-standing view that was at play here. I think what you actually really saw expressed was a much more sort of profound and substantial expression of really a way of looking at the whole world that has informed Jeremy Corbyn's sort of ideological worldview, really going back to long before he was leader of the Labour Party, even before he was even chair of the Stop the War Coalition, which is essentially, you know, it really does actually date back, you know, it goes right back to the sort of Cold War era, which is that essentially sort of Western power is a sort of capitalistic Western power is a sort of outcrop of an imperialistic, aggressive force in the world, and that anything that sort of seeks to contain that or resist that are the sort of the good guys, and sort of America in particular, you know, at its sort of in its pomp during the Cold War was more the bad guy. And so there is this almost this sort of muscle memory of an ideological habit of not really wanting to side with something that feels like a sort of an inflation of Western power in response to Russia in the East. And you saw that, I mean, you know, in not necessarily expressed directly by Jeremy Corbyn, but certainly by, you know, people who support him and people who now work in his office around the time of the Russian annexation of Crimea, for example. I mean, there the response was that essentially you should be siding with the Russians and that this was all had all come out of NATO aggression. So it's quite a specific and some would say a slightly peculiar jaundiced view of the world that seems to sort of default to thinking the West is the bad guy. And although I think, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and certainly other people on the left of Labour and in the Corbyn movement have tried quite hard, certainly on domestic policy, to reassure people that actually, you know, this isn't a very fanatical, wild ideological project. It's just a perfectly reasonable shift back to the left after many decades of moving to the right. And I think they've been quite successful in sort of neutralising some of that anxiety on the domestic stuff. When you get to foreign policy, and specifically when you get to foreign policy on Russia, there's a kind of an old habit that dies hard, and that really came out yesterday, and that's what Labour MPs, a lot of them, saw, and they just can't stomach that. It's too far for them.
But I think there are two, if I can come back, Raf, there are two lots of muscle memory at play here. And what was so particular about yesterday, I don't disagree with anything at all that you say, is that actually there are quite a lot of quite moderate people who thought that Corbyn actually had some points, that maybe May had been pushed into a corner, perhaps by her own more hawkish backbenchers, to act against, to declare the Russian state culpable and to act against it before actually, you know, the due process had been exhausted. Now, I know that's a really kind of contentious position, and I know that wasn't the only thing informing people like Hilary Benn and Yvette Cooper on the behind Jeremy Corbyn in the Commons, who felt very strongly they must make a stand against what you describe as Corbyn's kind of worldview. But nonetheless, there is a view that Corbyn may well be more, maybe right about Russia this time, as he would say he was right about Iraq 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, and no one has really any idea how this will play out in the country. I think, you know, as you say, there'll probably be quite a lot of people who will think, well, yeah, I mean, why, you know, maybe it was Russia, but, you know, we're entitled to see the evidence. I do think there is a slightly tricky thing here in terms of, you know, certainly kind of, you know, Corbyn's spokesman alluded to the Iraq example, saying, well, you know, can we basically trust intelligence sources? I think these are very, I mean, there are many ways in which these are different cases, but particularly I think the response here is very different, because we know that a chemical weapon has actually been used in Salisbury. So the political pressure and the sensitivity around this and the requirements actually to do something and act, it's in a completely different kind of order of things to whether this was some sort of abstract policy question of whether or not Russia is sort of hostile to the West or the West started it. And so I think in that sense, I don't think Theresa May really had much choice, and she made quite a compelling case to say, you know, this Novichok nerve agent stuff, there really isn't anyone that I can come across who's informed about these things who think there's any doubt that only the Russians have it, and they have the motive, in this case, various different motives, to use it in the way that they did. So it's sort of, I mean, it's not 100% beyond a reasonable doubt, but the argument that, you know, essentially the Russian state is responsible here is extremely compelling, at least to my ears.
And to be fair, though, Corbyn's spokesman was saying yesterday, clearly the Russians are culpable in some way, either because they've ordered this attack directly or because they've allowed this substance to somehow get into the hands of someone who shouldn't, you know, sort of lost control of supplies of this nerve agent or allowed it to take place, and they're culpable in some way. Although maybe that's too nice a distinction for this kind of case. I don't know.
I certainly heard had a Tory say to me this morning that, you know, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility. This is a Soviet era chemical weapon. It could therefore have been in one of the old Soviet republics. And I agree it takes a stretch of imagination, but you can construct a narrative which says that feasibly...
There were extraordinary measures were taken in the early 90s to make absolutely sure that the Soviet weapons capacity, particularly obviously with regard to nuclear materials, but everything else really, really didn't end up in Georgia or Kazakhstan or Latvia or anywhere else for precisely this reason. And so... again, I mean, I have yet to come across any remotely credible account of the last 3-4 days or even the last 20 years that would suggest that a government other than the Russian one would have been sitting on this substance. I mean, again, obviously it's not impossible, but when Jeremy Corbyn's office put that out there, frankly, it came across much more in the realm of smokescreen. There might be some possible explanation, willful exoneration of the Kremlin, rather than a serious attempt to construct possible, you know, plausible alternative outcomes.
Andrew, does any of this sort of disarray or disquiet get noticed to any extent in Moscow, or do they just see us as sort of uniformly hostile?
No, I think that these are the kinds of conversations that people in Russia are having. The conversation and discussion here is heavily shaped by television, I think, as it often is in terms of foreign policy. And the kind of discussion that we're having now, the nitpicking and establishing some kind of chain of custody for this nerve agent, I think is exactly where both the Russian people, you know, on the street, but also the Russian government is going to seek to poke holes in this theory. I mean, whatever happens in the future, the Russians are going to seek to sort of take the momentum out of the British argument by formalizing the process of investigating this, moving it to the OPCW, and doing much in the same way that, you know, what Jeremy Corbyn did yesterday, asking these questions of, well, can you actually prove the kind of step-by-step action and that none of this material was lost in Nukas, you know, in Uzbekistan or anywhere else like that.
I think we can hear now from the Defence Secretary, who dispensed with the diplomatic language and gave a speech in Bristol this morning.
It is absolutely atrocious and outrageous what Russia did in Salisbury. We have responded to that. Frankly, Russia should go away. It should shut up.
And it's not quite Churchill, is it?
No, but it is very Gavin Williamson, isn't it? The new, young, unbelievably ambitious defence secretary who, among other things, this morning revealed how very much he wants to get hold of the overseas aid budget, which he feels would be much better spent by his department in defence. In a way, it seems to me that the Tories are at risk of dissipating the advantage they probably gained in the public eye by Theresa May's very statesmanlike approach to this, and she's managed to come across as clear and quite compelling and authoritative in a way that she's often struggled to do on other matters. And to have senior members of her cabinet, senior in rank, if not in age or experience, treating it in what Heather rightly describes as a kind of sort of sub-Churchillian manner, it serves to diminish the whole, the seriousness of the situation in which we find ourselves.
More Alan Partridge than Winston Churchill, I fear. Raf, we do know there have been massive cuts in the budgets of defence and the Foreign Office in recent years. How much do they bite in weeks like this?
Probably defence, you'll get a bit more political traction at a time when people feel sort of vulnerable. I think the argument that because there's not as much ambassadorial staff around the place as there was before. You know, the Russians would have felt emboldened to let off a nerve agent in Salisbury. I mean, that doesn't really quite stack up. And also, it's quite normal, I suppose, at some level, that the opposition will turn any argument into a question of whether or not the adequate resources are there to deal with whatever the problem is at any given moment. That's absolutely reasonable and sort of normal politics. And you know, ministers might want to sort of game that sort of argument as well. There doesn't seem to be a very clear connection between this particular case, you know, the Salisbury incident, and you know, the defence budget or the Foreign Office budget. I do think, though, that, I mean, Gavin Williamson is one of those cases where this, when he was sort of rising up, and you know, he was a sort of a young MP, and you heard his name mentioned a lot, and he was supposed to be tremendously impressive. And it does happen from time to time. People get talked up in this way, and then you just see absolutely no evidence to support it at all. It is mystifying how anyone would have come to the conclusion that this was a sort of a formidable or impressive person, unless we're really missing something. And the sort of transparent grandstanding, and as Anne said, this weird attempt to very conspicuously hijack something of tremendous gravity, more or less in a sort of sophomoric, attention-seeking kind of way. And then you think, meanwhile, we've got Boris Johnson as our foreign secretary, which I don't think fills lots of people with confidence. And I don't imagine he's got a great diplomatic contact book that he can mobilise at times like this either, because he just annoys more or less everyone who's not British, and about half the people who are British. And you think, where are the grown-ups? You know, I mean, as Anne said, I mean, Theresa May at least, you know, looked and sounded the part yesterday.
Yeah, one of the allies that Boris Johnson's team often highlighted was his close relationship with Rex Tillerson. Well, we know how much good that'll do him. Anne, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I tell you, the other thing that strikes me as a weak point in the Conservative case, and one that was picked up by the Financial Times this morning, was the impression that the Conservatives are a little bit reluctant to tackle the money and London's role as a kind of sump for taking all the dirty stuff out of Russia. And I know the FT was quoting Russian opposition sources as saying this will encourage, a bit as you were indicating, Andrew, this will only encourage the Russians to think that they've got nothing to fear from London.
Andrew, Russia's now been implicated in disrupting the US election by hacking, state-sponsored doping programs in world sports, and now, again, the high-profile assassination of a former spy with a chemical weapon in the UK. What is it all for?
I think it's a million-dollar question. It's really hard to say where it all went in this direction. To be honest, I would say that maybe one idea is just because they can. You know, it doesn't seem that we've been through a lot of these different scandals going on. This investigation reminds me of MH17 to a certain degree as well, when, you know, there was a fair amount of evidence that Russia had shot down the plane, but because of their ability to kind of stick, to kind of jam in the wheel of this moving forward, that it never quite seemed that it really impacted the country. I mean, I think that there are a lot of grievances in Russia about the West, about the fall of the Soviet Union, the 1990s, and the sort of change in geopolitical strength since then, and a lot of scores to be settled. Russia feels that they haven't been given a fair shake in many ways, in terms of, you know, international law, in terms of their ability to kind of push their interests on the international stage. I think that some of those grievances are well grounded, but I do think that, you know, in some cases it's also become a bit of a, you know, it's turned into more than that. It's become a little bit more of a grudge match, particularly in the last couple of years. And I think that with what seems like, you know, another case of this, where it becomes a he said, she said kind of conflict with the West, I don't think that Russia really thinks it's come out of this conflict as the loser. I think that we can see pretty well that the Russians see this as maybe a draw, and they'll kind of move on to the next thing if they feel that it's in their interest.
Well, you can follow all the updates, commentary and analysis on this story as it continues on theguardian.com. Now, finally this week, in bygone days, spring would bring with it the budget, all the major tax and spend announcements in time for the start of the new financial year. Not so this year. The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, has moved the budget to the autumn, and instead of the autumn statement, we now get a spring statement, and a much watered-down affair it is. Earlier, I called Paul Johnson of the Institute for Fiscal Studies to get his take.
It really was just a spring statement. Philip Hammond delivered on his promise not to make this another fiscal event. There was essentially no new policy announcements, and actually the economic and fiscal forecasts we got from the Office of Budget Responsibility were not terribly different from those that we got in the autumn, which isn't so surprising. It's only 4 months since the last lot.
But he struck a very different tone, didn't he? He told us he was feeling rather tiggerish. It was a sort of upbeat mood, and also that he thought he might have some money to spare when he comes back to talk to us in the autumn.
Yeah, it was quite hard to discern what had changed to make him tiggerish. The borrowing numbers for this year are a little bit better than they look like they'd be in the autumn, but most of that washes out over the next 2 or 3 years. The economic forecasts are basically the same as they were in the autumn, a little bit better this year, but a little bit worse going forward. He did hint that he might have some money to spend in the autumn. We're going to get a spending review next year, and he said in the autumn budget he'll set the envelope for that. So how much will he have to spend? It's very hard to see how he can square increasing spending with his stated aim of getting to budget balance in the mid-2020s, unless he's got some very big tax increases up his sleeve.
And there were a lot of consultations published alongside the budget, but none of those pointed to, for example, how you might raise extra money to fund the NHS by raising taxes, did it?
No, the slightly disappointing thing about the spring statement was that we were promised, in the Chancellor's own words, consultations on how to deal with some of the big fiscal issues facing us in the long term. And whilst there were quite a number of perfectly sensible consultations about tax policy, they were mostly about, you know, important but relatively small details, and certainly not things that are going to raise the kinds of money that you'd need if you did want to increase spending and get to budget balance, or the kinds of issues that we face as a result of an ageing population, or the kinds of issues that we potentially face as a result of losing 20 or 30 billion a year from fuel duty in the long run. So they were picking important issues, but they weren't picking the big long-term strategic issues.
And it's worth saying also, isn't it, that the forecasts that the Office for Budget Responsibility have done don't really give us a sense of how the economy will be reshaped by Brexit, do they? They've made some broad assumptions, but they still say we don't really know what deal we've got or we will get. And so we can't really say yet what the impact will be.
It's in some ways, it's becoming increasingly, I'm not sure if amusing is quite the right word, but reading the way that the OBR describes their interactions with government around Brexit. I mean, for the fourth time now, they've essentially written in the beginning of their book, we wrote to the government and asked them what Brexit was all about, and they told us it meant Brexit and referred us to a few speeches by the Prime Minister, and therefore we no idea what's going on, and we've made what they call a broad brush assumption, which is essentially the economy will be 2% smaller as a result of it than it otherwise would have been. And that, you know, that's consistent with a very smooth and very soft Brexit, and that means there are risks on the downside if that's not the way we go.
So is it possible then that if the OBR does have some detail before we get the next forecasts in November, that actually Philip Hammond's room for manoeuvre might be even smaller than he thinks?
Well, I mean, the forecast certainly could get worse, and I think if the detail that comes through is that it's going to be more difficult than it looks at the moment, then it might go in the wrong direction. On the other hand, if we get an indication that it is going to be a relatively straightforward transition, it might go the other way. I mean, I think these forecasts are supposed to be sort of in the middle of the potential range, so you've got as much upside as downside, but there is definitely downside there.
Finally, Paul, it would be wrong to think, wouldn't it, given Philip Hammond's sort of upbeat tone, that austerity or that spending cuts to welfare benefits, for example, are over. There's still quite a lot to come on that front, isn't there?
There are still some big benefit cuts to come. In fact, of the pretty big package of measures announced by George Osborne after the 2015 election, about three quarters of those are not yet happened, because they're essentially, a lot of them are being rolled out relatively gradually for new claimants. So one of the things about the welfare cuts is that they're mostly not reducing the cash amount that any individual currently on benefits gets, but they're doing two things. First is they're freezing benefits, and that's having a big effect this year because inflation is relatively high. So whereas most working age benefits would have risen by 3% in normal times next month, they're not going to rise at all. And so that's quite a big real cut to the incomes of people on benefits. And secondly, the changes to tax credits and universal credit in terms of taking away any benefits from third and subsequent children, for example, are only affecting new claimants. So it's all being rolled out quite gradually, and it does mean that three quarters of the cuts that have been announced since 2015 are yet to come into effect.
George Osborne's moved off to be a newspaper editor, but his legacy lives on. Paul Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Tom Tugendhat, Anne Perkins, Andrew Roth and Raphael Baer. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.